terms of getting some credible leads. Andy felt strange talking to the head of Confederation Intelligence in the back room of a seedy Spacer's District Tavern, one she'd been in a dozen times without the slightest clue that it had been owned and operated by a front company for Holston's agency for more than a decade. I'd say Drake Trencher is the best, probably by a considerable margin. He's given me good leads in the past. We've made good money together. Do you trust him? Holston seemed nervous. Andy wasn't sure how much of that had to do with being out of his element on the rough-and-tumble frontier, and how much was regret and concern over enticing her into an operation that would almost certainly prove to be dangerous. Hell no. He's a Badlands border snake who'd sell his own mother if he could get a good price for her. We've worked together, usually successfully, but I've also come close to blowing his brains out a couple times. Do you really think he's the right contact? I don't want you to take any unnecessary chances. Gary, normal business on Danith is dangerous enough. You can't get a decent drink around here without taking some chances. If you want to root out Sector 9, expose their operations on the border, well, that's not going to be safe, no matter what you do. She paused. Don't worry, I can take care of myself. She looked over at Holston. He sent men and women into dangerous situations every day. But now she realized he was having second guesses about luring her into Confederation intelligence. Oh, I know you can, Andy. I'd never have come to you if I didn't believe that, but Sector 9 is... His words trailed off. They both knew enough about the Union's infamous spy agency to finish the sentence. What about my crew? If I'm going to use my return to Badlands prospecting as a cover, I need to look like I'm ready to head out at some point. They're ready, Andy. You can meet them all tonight. Let's say 10 p.m. at Pegasus. Inside your ship is about the one place we can be sure no one else is listening. Are they good? Reliable? They're the best I've got. Experienced operatives with military combat training. And they're all from my black team, which means they basically don't exist. Not officially, at least. Even if someone gets a DNA sample, they won't be able to track any of them down. Andy just nodded. She knew anyone Holston sent with her would be reliable. But she was still nervous. Coming back, working leads, and looking for some old tech, that was one thing. It just wasn't the thing she'd come to do. She was here to root out Sector 9's influence, and that was more difficult and dangerous by orders of magnitude. She had to push, to poke around places it wasn't safe to poke. If there was a code on the border, it was one of silence. People didn't ask about things that didn't concern them, and when they did, it usually led to trouble. She jumped at the chance to escape from her gilded prison, to flee from the boredom she'd begun to feel was killing her. But now she realized she felt a little out of her depth. She was scared. She looked up at Holston, trying to keep the concern from her face. Okay, 10 p.m. it is. I'll see you there. Alu Selton. Of course I'm certain. Don't you think I know Andy LaFarge? Trencher was annoyed, but he didn't let it affect his demeanor. It was an hour past closing time, and the bar was mostly dark, just a single light a few meters away throwing dim illumination across the table. It held that she is retired, that she's no longer prospecting for old tech. His contact was unemotional, cold. Trencher disliked dealing with the man. He'd almost told the new arrival to get lost when he'd first walked into the bar a few weeks back, but then the stranger recited a list of Trencher's debts, the legitimate ones, and also those he'd owed to rougher parties. It didn't take long for him to realize that whoever the new arrival was, he now held most of the ruinous debt into which Trencher had fallen so deeply. It was unnerving, but certainly an attention-grabber, especially when the mysterious man suggested a way Trencher could rid himself of his obligations. Yeah, I heard that too, but now she's back. She says her last score was good, but not enough to last. She's back looking to pad her stake. Do you believe that? As much as I believe anything. She'd lie to me if it suited her needs, of course, but why else would she be back here? She damn sure didn't miss the food, or the company. What did she want from you? What do you think she wanted? Trencher could see the man was not amused. He'd been dealing with the contact for weeks now, and the stranger had kept all his promises, at least so far. But there was something disturbing about him, too, almost foreboding. She wanted leads on old tech, of course. It certainly looks like she's planning another expedition. Trencher played his part in the strange ecosystem of the border planets. He was a middleman, really, and nothing more. Danith and the other worlds bordering the Badlands were full of people peddling clues about potential old tech finds. Some of them were of the bookish variety, researchers who examined old records and tried to find traces that might lead to something useful. Others were explorers without the resources or guts to follow up on their own discoveries. It was quicker and safer to sell off a lead and take a share of anything someone else found, assuming you could trust anyone else involved. That was where Trencher's value came in. He was a fixture on Danith Spacer's district. He owned several of its best-known establishments, and he had at least some degree of credibility with both the sellers and buyers of information.
"Did you make any arrangements with her?"
"No, I just told her to come back in a few days. She was alone, she had to put together a crew, and I wasn't sure what to tell her until I had the chance to speak to you."
"Very good. Whatever Captain Lafarge is doing here, I doubt it has to do with resuming old business practices. She..."
The man almost continued, but then he stopped abruptly.
"She?"
"Nothing important. The next step is to find out what she really wants."
"And just how do you propose we do that?" Trencher was hesitant. He didn't have any loyalty to Andy Lafarge, not really. The crazy smuggler had pulled her gun on him, twice. But she'd always dealt with him more or less honestly, and setting her up felt wrong. Besides, he'd seen her when she was angry.
"You will have your talk with her. Pass on the basics of any leads you may have, anything to catch her interest. Then explain that you have a contact with more detailed information. Tell her you set up a meeting, and bring her to us."
"You must be kidding. Andy Lafarge is no fool. She'll never go along with that." He stared at the man. He was wearing a long black coat, and Trencher was suddenly aware that any kind of weapon could be hidden under there. Not that the stranger needed to hold a gun to his head. Trencher was deep underwater, utterly ruined, unless his new associates honored their agreement to forgive his debts in exchange for his cooperation.
"Perhaps she wouldn't if she were operating the way she did before, but if we are right, she's fishing around for information herself, and I don't mean vague treasure maps leading to questionable chunks of old tech. She'll take chances she wouldn't have before, push harder to get what she's looking for."
Trencher was confused. He didn't understand what the man wanted with Andy Lafarge, but he knew he didn't have a choice. He had to cooperate, and hope his new friends kept their word and canceled his debts. And that Andy Lafarge didn't get pissed enough to put a bullet in his head.
"I may have something for you, Andy, something big."
Trencher's voice was soft, almost a whisper. The bar was about half full, fairly typical for the time of the night, maybe even a bit light, and the tables right around the booth were empty. Andy stared at him, trying to get a read on his expression. She'd always been good at judging people's motives and intentions, but Trencher was keeping a good poker face. Still, she was suspicious. If he really had something big, would he offer it to her now, like this? 2 years ago, perhaps. She had a good reputation on the border and a number of successes to her credit. But right now, she'd just reappeared after almost 2 years, with none of her old crew. No crew at all, as far as Trencher knew. She wasn't sure exactly what was going on, but her gut told her it was more than a promising run. Which is good, right? She spent her career being as low profile as possible, trying not to attract problematic attention. But now she was looking for trouble, at least in a way. Still, it felt strange, and it only increased her unease.
What are the details?
"I'm just a middleman on this, Andy. The group that found this came to me looking for a reliable crew. I was going to talk to Mercer or Alante, but then you showed up, fresh back from retirement." No, she was sure something was going on. Tom Mercer and his crew were pretty damned good, but Santiago Alante was another prospector at the top of the heap. His ship, Sombra, was almost twice the size of Pegasus. She had a decent relationship with Trencher, but she knew he'd never give her first crack at a prime job if he could get Alante and his people instead.
So it is a trap of some kind.
But the cold feeling in her gut reminded her of the unsettling truth. She was there to walk into a trap. It was the only way she could get the lead she needed to track down Sector 9.
Besides, if he wanted me dead, he could have had one of his people shoot me down right here.
That made her feel better. A little. Very little.
So how do we proceed?
Trencher looked back at her. He'd been doing an impressive job of hiding any tension. But now she caught a hint of it. Whatever he led her to, it wasn't going to be just another expedition.
"We go meet them, Andy."
He paused. "Now." She felt her insides tighten.
Trencher had taken her by surprise. She'd expected him to lure her somewhere else, but she figured she'd have a chance to speak with Holston first.
Now? No, that's no good. Let's do this right. You get to your people and set up a proper meeting, either here or—
No, Andy. It's got to be right now. The information is time-sensitive. The expedition has to leave quickly.
That's crazy. Set something up for tomorrow.
She had to at least seem to put up a fight. If she didn't, Trencher would become suspicious. He shook his head. I'm sorry, Andy. It's got to be now. They're very cautious, and the information is that valuable. Andy took a breath and swallowed hard. She almost told Trencher to forget about it. It was one thing to agree to work for Holston, to come to Danith and poke around, and quite another to walk blindly into a trap just to see who was behind it. Her eyes darted for an instant toward the door, toward escape. But she'd come here to do a job, and this was the next step.
Okay, we'll do it your way, but my new crew knows I'm here, and if you pull anything, they'll—
Everything is legit, Andy, and this looks promising enough to be that final score, the one that really lets you and me retire from all of this. He slid out of the booth and stood, waiting for her to follow. She hesitated for an instant. It was against every impulse she had to willingly walk into a trap. Finally, she stood up and nodded, and then she followed him toward the door.
Where exactly are we going?
Just down the street. There's a transport waiting.
Andy stopped. A transport? This whole thing stinks like garbage, Drake. What the hell is going on?
I told you they're being cautious, Andy. They've got a lot of resources committed. This is no ordinary run for a few scraps and parts. It's the real deal. And it's their way or no way. You want to walk, walk. But if you want to hear about what could be the biggest haul of your career, we do it their way. She listened, impressed by the sincerity Trencher managed to put into his words, even though she knew it was fake. She could sense the stress below it all. And something else. Fear. Drake Trencher was scared.
All right, let's go,
she said, trying to inject clear discomfort into her response, which wasn't hard at all since she was well beyond uncomfortable. The two of them walked out onto the main road and down several blocks. Then Trencher turned down a side street. It was a particularly dumpy section of the Spacers District, one frequented mostly by hardcore addicts and drunks, and lined by the absolute bottom of the barrel in terms of bars and other establishments. There were at least a dozen people passed out on the walkway, sleeping off whatever inebriation afflicted them. About a dozen vehicles were parked along the street. They were mostly ancient, dumpy trucks, more than one of them looking abandoned. One large black transport was parked at the next corner, new and gleaming. And expensive. Very out of place. There they are, Trencher said, extending his arm and pointing toward the vehicle. She glanced over at Trencher, trying to hold back the anger she felt. The bastard was setting her up. All the times they'd worked together, the money they both made, and he was selling her out. True, things had almost come to violence between them a couple times, but never due to outright betrayal. Besides, I wouldn't have really shot him. Probably not, at least. She walked down the street. It was taking all she had not to duck into cover in some alley, or at least to put Trencher down like the miserable backstabber he was. But she held it together and walked up to the transport, standing quietly as Trencher knocked on the shaded window. The door slid open a second later. It was mostly dark inside, but she could see it was a large space, and as plushly configured as the vehicle's exterior. Get in. Trencher was standing behind her, gesturing toward the open hatch. She angled her head back, her eyes catching his for an instant. If the son of a bitch thought he was going to muscle her into the transport. But she remembered why she was there. Whatever was inside the vehicle, it was at least a step closer to what she'd come to find. She took a deep breath and stepped in, sliding into an empty seat just past the hatch.
Welcome, Captain LaFalge. I am very glad to make your acquaintance at last. We have much to discuss.
The man speaking was sitting directly across from her. It was almost dark in the cabin, and his face was hidden in the shadows. Not that she'd recognize a Sector 9 agent anyway, if that was what she was dealing with. And she decided she was almost sure about that, at least.
And what might that be?
Her voice was hard, but she held back as much of the caustic tone as she could manage. She needed to get information from these people, and get out of this meeting alive, if at all possible. Needlessly antagonizing them wouldn't help her cause on any of those counts.
We'll get to that soon enough. Bedfast, where are my manners? Allow me to introduce myself properly. I am Ricard Lier, Captain Lefarge. Very pleased to finally meet you.
Chapter 11. Hall of the People. Liberté City. Planet Mont Meral, Gassara 4. Union Year 219. 315 AC. Desiree Marielis sat on the cold metal chair, waiting, tapping her feet nervously. She'd come as soon as she'd gotten the call, but she was still concerned she was late. There had been no time specified for an appointment, just a brief instruction to come immediately. She'd waited now for more than a year since she'd gotten back from the Alliance, waited for Gaston Villeneuve or one of his lieutenants to contact her, to bring her back into the fold, or for his killers to show up on her door. She'd watched the orgy of bloodletting that had accompanied the former Sector 9 head's transition from entrenched government apparatchik to revolutionary leader. The totalitarian regime he'd served, of which he'd been an integral part, was gone now, almost totally destroyed. Yet Villeneuve remained, head of a new order that had an iron grip no less powerful than that which had preceded it. Marielis had always respected Villeneuve, even considered herself one of his protégés, but now she had a new perspective on the depth of his genius. He'd somehow reinvented himself in the eyes of the mob that had murdered most of his former colleagues, and he'd done it with stunning success. She moved around on the chair, trying to get comfortable. She had wrestled without a dress for the meeting. First, she'd put on her black leather outfit, the one that fit her so well, the one she'd used to successfully seduce countless men and women in her previous missions. But then she'd had second thoughts, and in the end, she took a cue from Villeneuve himself, donning an ill-fitting set of gray factory clothes, the kind of proletariat garb he'd worn every time she'd seen him on the vid. She was uncomfortable in her new clothes, both because the fabric was stiff and coarse, and because the bulky unisex outfit hid every curve and contour of her body. She didn't like hiding any of her assets, though her looks and seduction skills were far from the only tools in her arsenal. Marielis was a stone-cold killer, a brilliant operative with an enormous skill set ranging from a fair hacking ability to expertise in a half-dozen styles of personal combat. But she hated being without even one of her weapons. She was also nervous, unsure what to expect when Villeneuve walked in. She doubted the absolute ruler of the Union would waste his time calling her into his office just to have her killed. There were far easier ways to see to that if he'd finally decided to do away with her. But she still wasn't sure he was going to offer her what she truly wanted. A way back in, a return to her former life as an operative. Sector 9 was gone now. The buildings, the ones that weren't very well protected secrets at least, burned or pulled down brick by brick. Thousands of the agents had been killed, most of them betrayed to the mob and murdered in the streets. The blood of so many of his operatives had greased Villeneuve's route back to power. Marielis knew many people would find that appalling, disgusting. They would hate and despise the man for such callous treachery and disloyalty. But she saw only brilliance in all Villeneuve had done, and she admired her former and future boss immensely. She indulged a small spark of optimism. She had achieved considerable success in her mission against the Alliance, almost single-handedly provoking a war between the Palatians and the Krillians. Tarkus Venius had refused to call back the fleet deployed against the Union forces at the bottleneck, so in that regard her mission had failed. But any reasonable analysis would show that she had been as successful as she could have been, especially working with as few resources as she'd been given. She'd created a serious threat to the Alliance homeworld. Venius's steadiness and courage in facing that danger and overcoming it had been a factor beyond her control. Still, her own opinion didn't necessarily extend to Gaston Villeneuve, and she'd been more than a little concerned when she came back, unsure how much blame for the war's failure he might heap upon her. Her worries had proven to be well-founded. Villeneuve had scapegoated many, shifted the blame from himself to whomever best served his purposes. Marielis had been left alone, though it was unclear whether that was because Villeneuve didn't blame her, or just because the worst of his rage and massacres occurred while she was still making the long journey back. She'd been uncertain what to expect when she arrived. At first, she'd cowered in a small apartment, one of her safe houses, feeling a wave of fear at every sound from the hallway. But as time went by, she'd begun to see cause to hope that she'd escape the wave of terror that had swept across Mont Meral.
Survival had been her initial concern, of course, but eventually she'd begun to worry about a future beyond just another day drawing breath. She had hidden resources, of course, as most agents did, but the widespread crash of the Union's currency had reduced the value of her reserves to almost nothing. She'd eked out a tolerable existence the past year, certainly better than most of Montmorel's inhabitants had managed, but she knew she would have to do something soon. Tolerable had never been Desiree Marielis's target. Then she got the message to report to Villeneuve at once. The fact that it hadn't come along with armed guards was cause for some hope, she'd realized almost immediately. But now, sitting there waiting, she was getting edgier as each minute slipped off the clock.
Desiree, what a pleasure to see you again.
The words pulled her from her thoughts, and she stood up, turning toward the door as Gaston Villeneuve stepped into the office. He looked vastly different than she'd remembered, thinner, for one thing, and clad from head to toe in factory worker's clothes, his pants stained, his worn leather boots covered in mud. She remembered him as perfectly groomed and tailored at all times, but now he sported a 3-day scruff and his hair was long and tousled.
Minister Villeneuve, please, Desiree, I am merely Citizen Villeneuve now.
He moved toward her and extended his hand, grasping her arm in the style that had become commonplace on Montmorel since the revolution.
Yes, of course, Citizen Villeneuve. I'm so glad that you sent for me. I know how busy you must be. There is far too little time in the day. Yet those in factories work long hours as well, doing their part to bring prosperity to our people's union. I can do no less.
I'm impressed, sir, by all you have accomplished.
Thank you, Desiree. But there are no cells here, only 2 citizens, both loyal and committed to the new future.
Indeed, citizen. Marielis was a little surprised at Villeneuve's intensity. For a moment she almost believed he had sincerely turned into the people's leader his propaganda had so widely promoted. But then he sat at his desk, a barely perceptible wince on his face as he landed in the hard and unyielding chair. He pressed a button on his desk and the door slid shut. A few seconds later, a small yellow light on the desk turned green.
We can speak more freely now, Desiree.
He gestured toward the small device on the desk.
I still have political enemies out there, I'm afraid, and caution is always warranted. The room is secure now.
I understand. She wasn't sure what to call him now. Sir? Citizen?
A citizen will do, Desiree. There is no sense in making things more complicated than they need to be. And we certainly don't want to risk carelessness in public now, do we?
He paused for a moment.
I wanted to speak with you about something important.
I was very happy to receive your communication. It had been so long I was afraid you...
Things have been... hectic. I'm afraid some matters have taken considerably longer than I might have hoped.
And I wanted to wait and see if you had a low enough profile before I decided to let you live.
He didn't say that, but she heard it in her head.
I understand completely, citizen. She understood better than she let on. She didn't have the slightest doubt that if her identity as a Sector 9 agent had become public, he'd have sacrificed her to the mob in an instant. The year or more she'd spent in fear and deprivation, waiting to see if she would survive. It had been a test of sorts, and she had passed.
We're forming a new organization dedicated to protecting the interests of this state, the People's Protectorate. I am actively recruiting individuals I believe have the ability to undertake certain missions, endeavors vital to the new Union's security.
Ah, the People's Protectorate. She'd heard whispers of the new organization before, mostly hints that its purpose was to root out any remnants of the old regime, and anyone acting against the interests of the Union's workers. At least that was what people were supposed to think. But she knew better than to believe what she heard.
He's building a new Sector 9. This is what I've been waiting for.
I am ready to help any way I can.
I wish all you would be.
Villeneuve paused and he smiled across the desk at her.
Desiree, I never had the chance to tell you this, but reviewing what survived of the files and reports, it appears you did an outstanding job with the Krillians. You got the Krillians to attack with no support from us, financial or otherwise.
Another pause.
The fact that the Pelations were too pig-headed to call back their ships from the front line is not your fault. You did everything I sent you to do, and far faster than I imagined possible. Thank you, Citizen.
Villeneuve smiled again. Don't worry, you'll get used to it. He looked down at himself, at the disheveled clothing he wore.
At least sooner than you will get to dressing like a factory laborer. But we do what we must, do we not?
Absolutely, Citizen. She smiled, too. The discussion was heading exactly where she'd hoped it would.
Desolée, I have something in mind, a plan for which I laid some of the framework before the change of government. It is not unlike what you did with the Krillians, though I'm afraid it is far broader in scope.
I am with you, 100%. You just have to tell me what you want me to do.
Villeneuve nodded.
I knew you would feel that way, Desolée. I am sorry you were on your own for so long. These are unsettled times.
Yes, they certainly are. So what can I do?
I want you to direct an ongoing operation to undermine a government. It's a longer-term project, one with many moving parts. It is complex, and I'm afraid it will be dangerous as well, but it is also one that offers great rewards. Unfortunately, it is not focused on a single individual, like your mission to the Krillians. It involves manipulating many individual politicians, some with debts or secrets we already control, others who will have to be enticed into the web one way or another.
It sounds like a major undertaking, Citizen. I would be honored to be a part of it.
You're not going to be a part of it, Desolée.
Her stomach tensed. Had Villeneuve called her here out of some perverse sadism, after all, instead of to recall her to duty? Or had she said something, done something, that might have angered him?
You're going to run the whole thing from top to bottom.
His words were a total surprise, and it took a few seconds for them to register. Finally, she managed to reply.
I don't know what to say, Citizen. I am very grateful for this opportunity.
You don't even know where I'm sending you, or which government you will be undermining.
She didn't care. Anything was better than scraping by as she'd been doing, skulking in obscurity with barely enough resources to survive. She'd go anywhere Villeneuve sent her, take on any mission he gave her, as long as it got her back on the inside.
This mission is of great importance, Desolée. I am trusting you with one of the three or four most crucial positions we've got.
He paused, and a hint of menace slipped into his tone.
You cannot fail. You will have substantially greater resources than you did on the Krillian operation, both in terms of personnel and finances. But you must get it done, whatever it takes.
He stated across the desk.
Do you understand me, Desolée?
She understood completely. She could feel the sweat beating on her back, the spark of fear rekindled inside her. Villeneuve was giving her a major opportunity, but the deal was the same as it had always been. Succeed and reap great rewards, or fail and die.
I understand.
Good, you have my complete confidence. Go now and wrap up any loose ends. You leave in 2 days.
Yes, sir.
She stood up, turning toward the door, but then she stopped and looked back.
Where am I going? What government will I be working to bring down?
Villeneuve had looked down at the desk, but now his eyes darted up and met hers.
You're going to Megala, of course. You're going to destabilize the Confederation government.
Chapter 12 CFS Repulse Z-4 System 8 million kilometers from CFS Dauntless. Year 315 AC.
Commodore, we're picking up a signal from Dauntless's patrol.
Sarah Eaton turned and looked over at her communications officer.
On the main line, Lieutenant?
Yes, Commodore.
A few seconds later, the bridge speakers crackled to life.
Dauntless, this is Ensign Pollock coming from Patrol 1.
Eaton could tell at once something was wrong. The pilot's voice was tense. And in a rookie mistake, he hadn't stated any details in his report, nothing but his ID. He was acting like he was on some kind of intra-ship line instead of sending a message from almost 2 late minutes from his mother's ship. Repulse was on the far edge of the fleet, which meant a turnaround time of just under 1 minute for communications, rather than just over 3 minutes for a message to return from Dauntless. If something was wrong, Repulse was far better positioned to intervene. She flipped the switch on her own headset and said, Dauntless Patrol 1, this is Commodore Eaton on Repulse. Report your situation at once.
She turned toward her tactical officer. Commander, let's get Gold Falcon Squad ready just in case we need them. Eden didn't expect any real trouble, at least nothing that rattled her battle-hardened sensibilities, but she was a big believer in being ready for anything. Gold Falcon Squadron, report to launch bay. Report Gold Falcon Squadron, report to launch bay. The officer turned around and looked back toward Eden. Gold Falcon Commander confirms order, Commodore. Eden just nodded. Then she leaned back in her chair and waited for a response from the patrol. Commodore, this is Ensign Pollock, serial number A456D711, in temporary command of Patrol 1. Nothing else. Eden shook her head. My God, this kid is a rookie. How did someone so wet behind the ears end up commanding a patrol? It didn't seem at all like Baron to send out someone so raw, and even less like Atara Travis, who most likely had selected the pilots for the mission. She shook her head. He still hadn't reported what was happening. Ensign, report your situation at once and in detail. She didn't snap, not exactly, but she put a little more oomph behind the command. She glanced over at the chronometer. Dauntless would be receiving the first signal in a few seconds, but it would take more than a minute and a half for any response to reach the fighters, and given the apparent lack of experience of Ensign Pollock, she imagined an exchange might go on for quite some time if she didn't intervene. Falcon's ready, Commodore. Eden was a bit surprised by the tactical officer's report. The Gold Falcons were her elite squadron, but they'd outdone even themselves. Their response time was bordering on the impossible. Launch Gold Falcon Squadron. They are to move toward Patrol 1's location, maximum possible thrust. She didn't want to exaggerate whatever was happening out there, but she always believed it was better to overreact a bit than get taken by surprise. And it was going to take time to get assistance to those pilots if they were in trouble, so the sooner that help started out, the better. Gold Falcon's launching, Commodore. A few seconds later, Eden could feel the gentle vibrations from the catapults. It was a softer sensation on Repulse than it had been on Intrepid. Her new flagship was larger and outmassed her old vessel by a good million tons. Perhaps half a minute later, Gold Falcon Squadron launched. Eden just nodded. Then the next signal from the patrol came in. Commodore Eden, we detected some kind of signal coming from the gas giant up ahead. Captain Stockton, he went forward to investigate. We can't raise him, Commodore, and we haven't heard from him at all since he got close to the planet. Eden felt her tension increase. It was one thing for some rookie pilots to get into trouble. That could be anything. Mechanical failure, an overreaction to natural phenomena. But Jake Stockton was the best pilot in the fleet. If he was having some kind of problem. It's probably just a system failure. Her discipline slammed down in place. There was no cause to panic, at least not yet. But why hasn't he contacted the fleet or the other ships of the patrol? Gold Falcons, continue to location of Patrol 1, maximum thrust. Further orders will be available when you get there. Yes, Commodore. Activate Tender 1, prepare to launch. Tender 1 crew to the bay. Eden sat quietly as her tactical officer carried out her commands, listening as Dauntless's reply to the patrol's initial communique reached Repulse. Eden turned toward the tactical station. Advise Dauntless we have responded to the patrol's communique and dispatched assistance. Yes, Commodore. She looked back at the main display. Most likely Stockton's fighter had just broken down, but there was no room for carelessness, not hundreds of light years from home. Bring Repulse to yellow alert, Lieutenant. She studied the locations of the ships in the fleet. Repulse was well out on the flank. If Stockton had found something, her ship was the closest. And launch Tender 1 as soon as it is ready. Stockton watched as the data continued to come in from his partially operational scanners. It was spotty, but his momentum was bringing him closer to the whatever it was, and that increased the clarity of data. He'd done the calculations twice. He was going to come within 100 kilometers of the thing, and that was practically a collision course in terms of space travel. He moved his hands over the controls, doing what he could to focus the scanning power he did have. He thought about shutting the scanners down entirely, saving his fuel for support, but he just kept working the controls. He had enough fuel to get back to the fleet, and he could use that to give him heat and air for a good while. Long enough for help to arrive, at least. He watched as the distance counted down on his screen. 2,000 kilometers, 1,900, 1,800. He was still too far out for visuals on the contact itself, at least with his fighter's limited optics, but he was getting clear data on the size and power figures. Whatever it was, it wasn't more than 100 meters in length.
Less, he realized as he crept closer. But the power figures were way above anything he'd expected. Whatever energy source that thing had, it was far more powerful than anything Confederation science could cram into so small a space. Antimatter. That was a guess. Stockton didn't have scanners capable of analyzing the trace radiation completely enough to determine if its source was an atomic reaction or antimatter annihilation. But somehow he just knew. The pre-cataclysm empire had mastered the production of antimatter. That much was well known. He was still stabbing in the dark, but now he was fairly certain he'd stumbled on a bit of old tech, one that appeared to be at least partially operational. Captain, Reed. His comm unit came to life, mostly static, with a few words he was able to pick out. Can you clean that up at all? He snapped to the AI, already clarifying and enhancing signal as it comes in. So that unintelligible blast of noise had been the communication after the AI worked on it. Just great. Stockton reached out to the communication controls. The scanner interference near the planet was significant as well, and he figured he'd better give his prospective rescuers an idea where he was. He didn't figure his own message would come through any clearer, but they really didn't need to know what he was saying, as long as they could trace the comm beam back to him. He put his hand to his headset, but just before he tapped it, his screen flashed, the brightness almost blinding. Another energy spike? Whatever it was, it had been strong. For an instant, he even thought the artifact had attacked. But he was still there, and he suspected if the device had wanted him dead, he would be. He wondered if he'd been scanned again. The last beam had been powerful enough to blow out half the electronics in his fighter. He looked around, checking each system in turn. If another scanner beam had hit his ship, there was no new damage. So probably not a scan. He sat for a minute, trying to figure out just what he'd seen. Then he shook his head. It didn't matter right now. There would be time later to analyze whatever his battered systems had managed to record, but the first step was getting back to Dauntless. This is Captain Stockton. My location is... He glanced down at the screen. 102.340.119. I found a contact I believe to be some kind of artifact, likely old tech. It appears to be operational. I repeat, it appears to be operational. He paused, then added, It has made no indications of being hostile. He doubted anyone was getting much beyond the general direction of the comm beam, but if his words got through, he didn't want to cause a panic. He was still nervous, of course, and he certainly considered the device a potential threat. But his nerves had calmed considerably as time had passed. Stockton, coming, minutes. He still couldn't make out more than a few words, but the signal was stronger than before, and that meant the ship transmitting it was getting closer. He had his scanner concentrated on the artifact, but now he switched it back to wide area. The interference was affecting the sensors as much as his comm, but after a few seconds he picked up a contact incoming. No, multiple contacts. It looked like a group of fighters. For an instant he thought his rookies had decided to follow him in, but then he realized there were too many contacts. It looked like a whole squadron and a larger ship of some kind behind the fighters. The retrieval boat, he realized, with a full squadron escort. Whoever had gotten his patrol's call for help wasn't taking any chances. Raptor, is Gold Falcon Squad here to assist? The signal was beginning to clear up as the contacts moved closer. He could see them shift their vector slightly, and he realized they had locked onto his comm beam and were following it in. Gold Falcon, they're on Repulse, of course. Commodore Eaton's ship is the closest. She must have responded before the call even reached Dauntless. Gold Falcon, this is Raptor. My thrusters are disabled. Exert extreme caution. I'm approximately 800 kilometers from a contact I believe to be an old tech artifact. Archer here, sir. Sit tight, Raptor. We're on our way, along with the tender to tow your bird back to base. We keep our eyes out for your artifact. Roger that, Archer. Stockton let out a relieved sigh. He hadn't been too worried, at least not once he'd realized the artifact didn't seem like it was going to blow him to bits. But knowing help was almost there left him free to feel some excitement at the find, and curiosity about the artifact. This is what we came to find, after all. I've told you everything, sir. Several times. Stockton held back the last remark. He'd always been a bit of a maverick, but even his instincts called on him to keep silent with what would undoubtedly come across as a snotty remark to the Admiral.
The scanner beam was powerful, strong enough to blow out half my systems. I lost engine control along with most of my own scanning capacity.
But you weren't attacked at all?
No, sir. It hadn't sounded like a question, but Stockton answered anyway.
Any thoughts?
Baron looked out across the conference table. Atara Travis was there, and Sarah Eaton, Cillian Globus, every key officer in the fleet. The first contact with what appeared to be a substantial artifact was the most crucial moment in the fleet's journey to date.
It has to be an Imperial artifact. What else could it be?
Travis looked over at Baron. I don't have an alternative hypothesis. She angled her head, looking at the others. Does anyone else?
I'm inclined to agree with you, Atara, Baron said after no one else responded. So the key questions are, what is it? What, other than basic chance, explains why it's still working when all other old tech we found was in some state of inoperability or decay? Is it dangerous? He paused. We picked it up, and that didn't trigger any sort of attack.
The artifact had activated its scanning beam several more times since fleet units had put it under close surveillance, but nothing resembling a weapon had been detected yet. Still, Baron wasn't taking any chances. The thing was likely powered by antimatter, and that alone was a good reason for caution. He'd ordered the shuttles that had towed it back to the fleet to stop 10,000 kilometers from Dauntless, and he'd dispatched his engineering teams to inspect the device there. It was far more difficult to analyze the thing in space, but he wasn't about to bet his new vessel's survival on an antimatter containment system he guessed was over 4 centuries old. It wouldn't take more than a nanosecond's failure in the magnetic field to release enough antimatter to blow Dauntless into a cloud of superheated plasma. He'd hesitated to send the teams at all. Keeping the artifact away from Dauntless would protect the flagship in the event of a catastrophic failure, but it would do nothing for his engineers and technicians. Anya Fritz and her best people were clad in spacesuits even at the moment, prowling around the ancient device. It wouldn't take a massive antimatter explosion to kill every one of them. Even a modest defensive weapon or just an accident in the deadly environment of space would be enough to wipe out the research party. He'd led his people into so many dangers he'd nearly lost count. But it was always hardest to order a small, hand-picked group to put themselves in jeopardy. At least in battle they all shared a similar danger. He knew Fritz had practically leapt out of the airlock, almost overwhelmed by enthusiasm to inspect the new find. He'd have had to have her shackled and thrown in the brig to keep her away, but still, he felt responsible for whatever might happen to her.
I suggest we wait, at least for the preliminary inspection report.
Eaton was tapping her fingers on the tabletop, a sure sign Baron knew that she was as edgy as he was.
Then we'll have more to go on.
What more will we have, Commodore?
Globus had been quiet since the meeting had started, but now he spoke up.
We know that device has to be old tech, and we also know that it was deployed near a transit point. I say it's leading the way for us. We've made mostly random navigational choices to date, but I'd say now the route is clear. We should advance through that point and see what lies beyond.
Baron wasn't surprised that the commander of the Alliance contingent was in favor of the most aggressive option, but he was a little less prepared for how much he suddenly realized he agreed. The condition of the find suggested that the fleet might run into more functional old tech, and he was nervous that meant possibly hostile artifacts. But part of him wanted to push forward immediately to see what lay beyond the transit point. The fact that the artifact had been situated so close to one of the system's 5 points did suggest that perhaps it was indeed a route toward the heart of the old empire.
Your enthusiasm speaks well of you, Cillian, but I believe we should at least wait and see what the engineering team is able to uncover on their initial inspection.
He glanced over at the chronometer.
In fact, we should be hearing something any time now.
Baron leaned back in his chair.
We also have to consider how we'll proceed when we do transit. We will proceed through the one situated near the artifact. Does everyone agree?
When no one offered a different opinion, he continued. We must organize the fleet into a more, for lack of a better word, combat-ready formation. If we can find one artifact in functional condition, we could find others, including warships and other weapons under robotic control. We have to be ready.
I humbly request that my forces be placed at the head of the fleet admiral as the advance guard.
Globus again, this time acting so much like capitulation, Baron had to struggle not to grin. He couldn't risk offending Globus by refusing his request, though he knew the Alliance ships were a generation behind their Confederation counterparts in terms of scanning and computer analysis capability.
I accept your offer, Commander, but I'm afraid your force is a bit smaller than I'd like for the forward unit. so I will assign a group of Confederation ships to join you.
Sir, if it is acceptable to you, I would like to take Repulse to the front of the fleet.
Very well, Commodore Eaton.
And thank you, Sarah. Eden's request would put the fleet's exec with the advance guard. She would outrank Globus and, as such, command the entire advance guard. Baron wasn't concerned about Globus's tactical ability nor his courage. But he was just a little afraid the Palatian might blast something a bit prematurely.
Alliance officers worked on a kind of a partially submerged paranoia, most likely a vestige from the days when their homeworld was subjugated and their ancestors slaves. It didn't take more than the slightest signs of hostility to bring out their warlike sides. Sarah Eaton was a hell of a fighter, one he'd match against any Palatian in battle, but she was far more likely to try to avoid hostilities than Globus.
Very well, Commodore, take Repulse and... Baron thought for a few seconds.
Courageous and defiant, as well as two squadrons of escorts. You are to advance with full combat protocols, but remember, we're not looking to provoke anything. I want you to exert maximum caution at all times. Is that understood?
Yes, sir.
Baron nodded to her. She understands. He was just about to dismiss the meeting when the comm unit buzzed.
Admiral, I've got Captain Fritz on your line.
Put her through.
He looked up.
If you will all remain for another moment, it looks like we may have some information on the artifact.
Admiral!
Yes, Fritzy, I'm here in conference with the other senior commanders. Do you have anything for us?
Yes, sir. We're pretty sure the device's purpose was surveillance, some kind of satellite or drone. My guess is it was positioned where it was to warn of anything approaching the transit point.
Baron nodded. That makes sense. He looked up, turning toward the others at the table. It also supports our theory that this transit point leads toward the center of the old empire. He turned back toward the comm unit. Anything else, Fritzy?
Yes, sir. It's antimatter-powered, as we suspected. As far as we can determine, the containment system appears to be completely sound, but I still recommend we keep it some distance from any of our ships. It's quite advanced, sir, but...
She paused a few seconds. But? Speak your mind, Fritzy.
But it seems noticeably lower tech than some of the other devices we've encountered. The stealth generator, and certainly the planet killer, were more sophisticated in design and construction. I was never able to examine the pulsar, of course, but I feel comfortable in saying that, too, was considerably more advanced. I can't be sure about this, but if I had to guess, I'd say this device was built by a culture several centuries behind the ones that constructed the other artifacts.
Baron sat silently for a moment. That didn't make any sense. The old records were spotty and incomplete, but he'd never heard anything about more than one entity existing in the pre-cataclysmic past. The Empire ruled all mankind for centuries, if not millennia, and it had never encountered any alien civilizations. What could explain two distinctly different technology levels, both far in advance of the Confederation's?
Do you have any explanation, Fritzy?
He knew the answer even as he asked the question.
No, sir, none.
A pause.
And I have something else, Admiral. We can't be sure, not until we can bring samples back to the lab aboard Dauntless, but... Well, sir, we think this artifact is newer than the ones we found before. Perhaps not much more than a century old, and no more than two.
Do you know what you're saying, Fritzy?
Yes, sir.
Baron shook his head. The Empire had been destroyed nearly four centuries earlier. It seemed impossible that anything like the artifact could have been produced after the cataclysm, even if some vestigial civilization had endured longer than the old records suggested. The Confederation was over 100 years old, and Megara's history was well documented back at least another century. Yet Fritz was saying the artifact they just found was from roughly that time period. Baron almost asked if she was sure, but she'd said flat out that she wasn't, that she needed to verify the results. That meant there was still some doubt. Perhaps the new artifact was simply a cheaper, lower-quality item from Imperial times. He didn't really believe that. He was inclined to take Fritz's instincts as proven fact, but he wanted as much solid data as he could get.
All right, Fritzy, get your people back here immediately. Run whatever tests you have to, but get me solid information on this.
Yes, sir.
Baron leaned back, deep in thought for a moment, almost forgetting the others in the room. Then he exhaled forcefully and said,
You all heard Captain Fritz. If she confirms her suspicions, we've got another mystery on our hands, the implications of which I can't even delineate right now.
The room was silent, every eye on him.
There's no point in getting ahead of ourselves. Take a break, get something to eat. We'll reconvene as soon as Captain Fritz is able to complete her test.
And then we'll try to figure out what the hell is really going on out there.
Chapter 13. The Promenade. Spacer's District. Port Royal City, Planet Danith, Ventica 3. 315 AC.
Thank you for your assistance, Mr. Trencher. You may consider your debts paid in full.
Trencher nodded, clearly trying to avoid eye contact with Andy.
Thank you, he finally said, his voice weak, soft. Then he turned and walked away.
Andy sat silently, watching as Trencher slipped out of sight. He'd done what she needed him to do, led her right to the top of the Sector 9 presence on Danith, though the circumstances of that discovery were far from ideal. And it wasn't going to stop her from putting a bloody hole in the treacherous bastard's head when she got back.
What's this about?
She glared at Lié. She was in deep now, she knew that. But she still had to play the part.
It's about employment, Captain Lefauche. You came here under the pretense of prospecting for old tech, but I'm afraid I don't believe that is the case. I think you are looking for us at the behest of your friends from Confederation Intelligence.
He paused and turned toward the man sitting next to Andy.
Have you found it yet?
The man was holding an instrument of some kind, a probe with a cable connected to a small screen.
Yes, sir. It's in her left arm, approximately 3 centimeters below the elbow.
Andy was watching, and getting a very bad feeling.
Do it.
Lié's voice was calm without anger, but she could hear menace in it nevertheless. The man grabbed her arm. She pulled it back, but then another man, the one sitting across from her, punched her. She saw it coming too late and managed to get partially out of the way, but it still hit her hard. She gasped for a breath as her assailant lunged out of his seat and grabbed her left arm, holding it like a vice. She struggled, but both men were larger and stronger, and she was woozy from the punch. She felt fingers on her arm, feeling around for a few seconds, and then pain. It was a blade of some kind, digging deep. She tried to hold back a scream, but it forced its way out. She could feel the blood pouring out onto her arm and something metal digging into her flesh. She gripped her teeth and struggled to get out of her assailant's grip, but to no avail. Finally, the man next to her said simply, "Got it." He was holding up a small piece of metal, just under a centimeter in length, and covered in blood and tiny bits of muscle tissue. It was her tracker, the device that allowed Holston and his people to follow where she was taken.
Excellent.
Lié's voice was unchanged. He reached out and took the capsule, handing it to a woman seated next to him.
See that this ends up in another vehicle, perhaps one heading downtown. We might as well give our friends at Confederation Intelligence an interesting ride while we have a chat with Captain Lefauche here.
Andy was hunched over, whimpering slightly at the pain despite her best efforts to hold it back.
Here, Captain.
Lié handed her a long strip of bandage. He turned toward the man next to her, the one who'd sliced open her arm.
Help her with this. The captain is our guest, after all.
He angled his head back toward the front of the vehicle.
Let's get moving. We don't want to be at the last place Confed Intelligence got a leading from that thing.
The man grabbed her arm and began to wrap the strip of cloth around the wound. The material was bright white, but it quickly became soaked through with blood.
I must apologize, Captain Lefauche, for our apparent lack of manners, but we couldn't allow your friends from Confederation Intelligence to crash our little party. Not so soon. We have so much to discuss, and I'm afraid they would just spoil things.
What do you want from me?
She took a deep breath, fighting to ignore the pain as much as she could, and she stared at him, making no effort to hide the hatred in her eyes.
Confederation Intelligence sent you here to uncover our operation on the border. Frankly, I've been shocked at how freely we've been able to infiltrate the worlds along the Badlands all these years.
I don't know what you're talking about. I'm just here to prospect for old tech.
Captain Lefauche, we're going to get along much better if we respect each other's intelligence. I will confess, I wasn't sure you were working for Holston's people, not until Trencher got you to the vehicle. My studies of your adventures suggest you're far too cautious to go along with something like that, unless you are trying to uncover our operatives.
Andy stayed focused on Lié, but she didn't say anything.
Well, we can leave that unspoken. Any doubts you are working for Confederation Intelligence were eliminated the instant Sid here pulled the tracker out of your arm. Your people have been using those for far too long, I'm afraid. They might as well tattoo operative on your forehead.
Andy remained silent, but any hope she'd still had of convincing Lee she was just on Danith to make prospecting runs slipped away.
I will be blunt, Captain. We want you to work for us instead. I assure you, we are more generalist paymasters than Confederation intelligence, and we would like to employ you in operations far closer to your expertise than the folly galley Holston lured you into.
She glared across the transport small cabin toward Lee. Yes, your incentive program is quite clear. She held up her bloody arm, wincing from the pain as she moved it.
That was an unfortunate necessity, Captain. Had it been possible to have, shall we say, more of a medical environment available, we might have been able to achieve it with less discomfort.
Drop dead. Her words were cold. Lee sighed.
Your friend, Mr. Trencher, was far more reasonable. Once we'd taken over his debts, it was quite easy to secure his cooperation. I would advise you to follow his lead, Captain.
Trencher's a foul pig, and he's going to be short one head as soon as I can get out of here and blow it off.
She felt defiance inside rising, bolstering her courage. Fear was there too, of course, and she knew it would be a struggle to hold it back. She'd faced Sector 9 before, and the experience had not been pleasant. But Ricard Lee was something else entirely. She'd heard of him, shadowy rumors and stories always told by someone who said they'd been told by someone. She wasn't sure what was true and what wasn't, but she doubted there was anything he wouldn't do to get what he wanted, and that suggested the coming hours and days were likely to be very challenging.
Yes, I believe you will, Captain, and you'll have that chance, as long as you cooperate with us.
That will never happen.
Ah, Andy. May I call you Andy?
She glared back, silent, unwilling to play Lee's little game.
I'll take that as a yes. Anyway, Andy, many people have said that before, and they have suffered needlessly. Although Sector 9 no longer exists, my people have considerable experience in this area.
Do what you're going to do, but don't treat me like a fool. You can call a bucket of maggots a vase full of flowers. It's still a bucket of maggots.
There was venom in her tone. She was harnessing her rage to bolster her courage.
You're as charming as I had held, Andy. I'd like to say this is going to be a pleasure, but despite your obvious opinions of me, I'm not as sadistic as you imagine. I will admit I do enjoy the excitement of the kill, but the exhilaration is in the hunt, the chase. Inflicting pain on a helpless captive. Well, there are some in my employ, I dare say, derive a level of pleasure from that, but I assure you, I'm not one of them. You may believe me or not, but I would be just as happy rewarding you, enticing you to our service, rather than breaking you.
He paused, and though his tone remained even, Andy could feel a new level of malevolence there.
You would also be more useful in such a scenario. We will, of course, break your will if we must, Andy, but I feel you will be a stubborn candidate, and it will take aggressive means to bring you around. Such methods are not without consequences, or long-term effects.
Andy sat still, trying to keep herself from letting Lee know how scared she was. She wouldn't give the son of a bitch the satisfaction. She angled her head and looked right back at him.
Do whatever you're going to do. Anything would be better than listening to you talk me to death.
Holston's eyes were fixed on the small dot on the screen. He was sitting in the back of a transport, not the kind of luxury vehicle to which he was accustomed, but one that appeared to be a nondescript delivery truck of some sort. The vehicle looked old and somewhat run down, but it was actually almost new, and the special equipment inside cost 20 times what even the most high-end of transports did. The vehicle was moving down the street through relatively light late-night traffic. That was good. Holston's truck was following another transport, and it was crucial to stay close. The dot on the screen was Andy LaFarge's tracker, and his newly recruited agent was being taken somewhere. Holston was nervous, on the verge of ordering the half-dozen vehicles he had in play to converge on the transport and extricate Andy from whatever situation she was in. He'd held back, not wishing to interfere with any operation she might be conducting. He knew where she was because of her tracker, but he had no idea if she was there willingly or if she was a captive.
I want units 4 and 5 to move up. I don't want that transport out of sight.
Yes, sir.
The driver was one of his agents. Everyone involved was a Confederation intelligence operative, except for the detachment of Marines and, of course, Andy LaFarge. No, Andy is one of